teaching flood at the University of Minnesota in the B Lab, and I have a pretty good job. I work with about 50 professionals. About half of the group spends their time doing honeybee research, and actually a third of the group does native bee research, and a third of the group is the program that I run, the Bee Squad. So we have about 18 employees, and it's all paid positions, and literally their job is to support bees. But when we talk about bees, we're not just talking about all the honeybees out there. We're talking about native bees. Now, how many native bee enthusiasts do I have here? Now, it should have been everybody, guys. Great, I see you in the back. So, can anybody in here tell me how many different native bee species you have in Colorado?
I heard you this morning. 1,000.
About 1,000. Yeah, who was with me this morning? See, that's what I want to hear. About 1,000 different native bees in Colorado. And so when we talk about bees and we talk about if bees can save the world, we're talking about two different kinds of bees. In my opinion, we're talking about some bees that are managed. They're not native to the United States, and they are, in my mind and in my work, they are livestock. They are bees that we need to take care of. We have artificially changed how we are how they live. We're taking them from the cavities in the trees, and we're putting them in boxes, and we are bringing them closer together than they would live if they were making the decisions themselves. So those bees are our managed honeybees. And then when we talk about the other bees to see if they can save the world, those are the diverse bee species that we have, not just in Colorado, but throughout the world. About 20,000 different bee species in the world. So I work under Dr. Marla Spivak, and I think I'm channeling her. If she was asked the question, do bees save the world? I think that she would say that maybe we think like bees and we pay attention to what the bees need and we act on those principles, we would have a lot better chance because bees need clean food. They need habitat. They need clean water. And so we can have our bees probably help us save the world, in my opinion, only if we're keeping our honeybees extremely healthy and we're not creating a public health epidemic for them, which is what we're experiencing, not just in the United States, but all over the world in different capacities. But if we're also making sure that the great diversity of bees that we have across the country is maintained across the world is maintained. And I'm thinking for more hour, but they're very smart people, so I don't know.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I also wanted to tell the audience that we're going to be using two methods of asking questions during this session. One is through the CWA app, or you may also write a question down on a white card, and Kelly has these cards, so raise your hand.
Vanessa has them.
And Vanessa has them on that side, too. And write your question down. When you're finished with your question, please raise it high, and someone will come and take the question from you. So we'll hear from all the panelists, and then we'll get questions from all of you. So thanks, Rebecca. And our next panelist is Aaron Makaruk. I hope I said that right. He's the CEO of OSB Hive here in the Colorado. Really interesting guy. He's a Shuttleworth Fellow as well. So that means maybe you know if the bees can save the world.
You guys hear me? So I get asked, you know, how did I get into this line of work? And I'm actually not much of a bees historian. I didn't know, but I didn't do that originally. I'm kind of a son of older. I went to CU. I was a liberal activist. I worked for Amnesty International, and I studied Churchill and worked with Navajo rights. I just tried to, you know, be part of the anti-war protests in 2003. Leading up to that, I'm just kind of a concerned citizen. But after I graduated, I started a nonprofit going into prisons teaching music to kids in the judicial system. And that just reached its 10th year anniversary, and it's growing really strong, and that kind of gave me some credibility So that when I reached out to this guy, his name was Dr. Marcin Jacobowski. He's a TED fellow. If you watch his TED talk, he's building open source innovation. His talk has been viewed a couple million times. So I just reached out to him, told him what I had been up to, and he hired me, and I ended up working at this epicenter, all this collaboration happening internationally. The idea is that if we rely on the existing economic structure that we have now, automation is going to replace a lot of our labor. A small minority of our population is going to end up owning all profits of our economy, and the rest of us are going to have to figure out what to do. So rather than just becoming communists and wanting to violently overthrow the capitalists and take control of the means of production, I don't want to live that kind of lifestyle, we decided, let's just build our own means of production. Let's build our own innovation that solves our problems and then open source that. Share that online, document it so that everybody can use it, refine it, make it better. So for a couple of years, I worked with Marcin in Missouri on his farm, building open source innovation. People were flying in from all over the world. Engineers, scientists, he went to Princeton. I mean, really smart people and also just really people with good hearts. So out of that kind of nexus of innovation, I came up with this idea that we could use open source electronics and citizen science to study why bees are dying and maybe do something about it. So that was 2013. We did a Kickstarter, or we did an Indiegogo campaign, and it just kind of went viral. And then I got a fellowship from Mark Shuttleworth, and that gave us the seed money we needed to build the company that we now have, which is called Open Source Beehives. And what we do is we put smart devices inside beehives, and we use beehives sick immediately, and then they can intervene, prevent their bees from dying. But also, we're onboarding, we kind of went through the Boomtown Accelerator program here in Boulder, and we're starting to grow and mature as a company, and we're taking on new investment. So what that's going to allow us to do is, we just spent like 4 months writing a really extensive R&D plan. What we're going to do is digitize all the existing bee-related research, stuff that's just sitting on dusty shelves, but really high-quality research. We're going to make that available to the general public, machine-readable, and then we want to make recommendations built into our platform so that you know what to do to keep your bees healthy, happy, and productive. But also, as you know, you use your intuition and convention and you log what you do in the app, that data will help make our entire system smarter for everybody. So we now have 2,000 hives in our network across 25 countries. We built the largest data set on honeybee health metrics in the world, with 3 million sensor readings and over 1.1 million audio recordings. And we have a third-generation product that's coming out later this year that will be available for commercial beekeepers and backyard beekeepers alike. We'll be able to transmit that over miles of range, run for months without solar power, integrated seamlessly within a hive. I'm sure lots of people are wondering about emissions, radio emissions, and how that impacts bees. We can talk about that later in the Q&A section. But we're starting to get some traction, but the roots of this are just in me being a concerned citizen. You know, I don't have fancy credentials. I don't have a lot of education. But I wanted to do something about it. I was able to tap into a network of active citizens who wanted to collaborate with me together. That's why I'm doing this.
Excellent. That's a wonderful thing. Thank you so much. Now we also have Leslie Price with us, and as you know, at CWA panels, we bring a wide range of expertise to the panel, so we get different points of view. And Leslie Price is a designer, and she lives in Copenhagen, although I think she's Australian.
Yes,
that's right. Begin with. And she encourages award programs and people to innovate solutions to problems. So do you think that bees will save the world?
Well, I mean, it's definitely a topic I'm passionate about. I guess just to give you guys a bit of background, I work for an organization and we basically promote any kind of design and innovation that improves quality of life for people, but of course improves quality of life for the environment. And obviously bees are a huge, huge part of that. I guess I've been put on this panel because, we run that large-scale awards program, and this is a biennale, so it's been run every 2 years, and it started first in 2005. And what is really interesting is in recent years, more and more so, we're seeing designers and innovators really shift their attention onto bees, and they're coming up with all kinds of really interesting solutions. I'm interested to hear your opinion on these. But yeah, we've seen some really interesting stuff, particularly this year in 2019. We're seeing them come up with these synthetic foods, or foods basically for bees, to basically build up their immune systems. I don't know what you guys think about that. It's all very interesting. Different kinds of hives, you know, these hyper-designed hives to try and encourage people in the cities to, you know, have beehives in their gardens. What else have we seen? We're even seeing sort of artists come up with these sort of conceptual synthetic pollinators. And even though they might be not that pragmatic, it's just very interesting that people are very much engaged in this topic and they really want to contribute somehow, or at least, you know, raise awareness. We've also seen programs where people want to train bees to pollinate certain kinds of crops. I don't know if you guys have heard about that one. I have no idea about the... if it works or not, but I mean, it's a very interesting topic, particularly in design and innovation, so I'm really interested to hear from you guys, so thanks very much.
Excellent. So I'd like to take a minute and let both of you respond to some of those innovations, and what do you think about some of those design ideas we just heard?
Okay, so it's interesting to me how much humans want to help. And there are so many beekeepers out there who've actually become beekeepers because they've heard messaging that says, in order to help the bee population, you should become a beekeeper. Or they've heard the message that we don't have enough honeybees out there. And so some of the solutions, like more bees, if it's honeybees, it's actually not good for them. Honeybee losses are being driven by Varroa destructor. The parasitic mite came to the United States in 87, or was discovered in 87, and in that 32 years since Varroa arrived, it's become not just a parasite that kills the colony in a couple of years, it's become a vector of pathogens that can take a colony down in, I've seen it happen in 3 months. And so bringing bees closer together, I'm a huge fan of bees on the rooftop. I'm a huge fan of beekeepers. But I think the humans trying to get bees really close to them, or have too many honeybees, or even our native bees. Native bee houses are so cool. But data are showing that if you are not really careful, it is a great way to actually help pathogens spread. And so some of the things that we want to do and by design actually might be hurting instead of helping.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because one of the best things we can do is we can let the bees live the way they want to, so we can have the messiest lawns. We can have the most number of flowers out there. We can really change what we think is beautiful. And if we do that, we are going to make some serious progress.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think in an ideal world, we wouldn't have to put sophisticated technology inside of a beehive just to protect a species. I think that's kind of it's a ridiculous vision if you frame it like we need to put a sensor in every hive. Instead, I think what we should be doing, as you mentioned, is we should make good beekeeping knowledge accessible to the public. So when you're a new beekeeper and you want to get involved, no one's going to stop you. You're going to do it if you want to, but you should be guided with best practices. And so part of what we're going to do is make, you know, training curriculum available in the app so that when you log in, you're guided on what to do. And that'll be based on expert input from people like yourself. But also, I think there's a lot of promise in the idea of promoting a campaign where the average citizen builds pollinator habitats in their local environment, and then they can log that they've done so kind of in a public database, and we can start to measure the impact that that has on honeybee health through our sensor system, but also through direct observation from beekeepers. Because you don't need to buy the tech or have hardware in your hive to participate. You can just manage your hive and then log what you've done, and then we can track that data just through manual input over time, and that helps as well.
Sure. I mean, what I would like to say is, and I mean, you're totally right, Rebecca, we see so much innovation and design, and, you know, one invention creates three new problems. So, I mean, what I would like to know specifically is, are there any kinds of areas or, you know, problems that you think design or innovation could really solve instead of, you know, people designing hives or, you know...
So that's a great question. And I'm guessing you're already on top of this, but it is, it goes right back to bee food. And if we can figure out how to redo our landscape, and we work with like a lot of farmers who are really already on top of this. Do I have any farmers in the audience? I wish we had about 30 farmers in the audience, because on our lots, you know, my lots are really, the property I own is really small, but the property that farmers run will operate really big. You're working on a big scale of design, and once you start multiplying, changing piece by piece and adding it, and then tracking it with your app, you can really change the landscape so that it is almost less for us and more for the environment. And I'm not against a soccer field, but we've got a lot, where I'm from, we have got a lot of green grass, and we've started bee lawn research at the bee lab, so we're trying to, at least if you need a manicured lawn, put some flowers in it. But it's that incorporating into design nutrition for not just, you know, we can expand it, not just the bees, but other beneficial insects and wildlife.
So. What about like Paul Stamets' work, the mycelium, and promoting like healthy gut biomes?
Yeah, so that's a bee question. Want to talk about it?
go ahead. I can talk Aaron, about it. Aaron, why don't you tell everyone what you just asked and answer it, hopefully.
You guys have probably, most people have probably heard of Paul Stamets. He's like a leading mushroom researcher, and he's got a line of supplements, and he's building these kind of mycelium-based kind of probiotics. They promote a healthy gut biome for honeybees so that they can uptake nutrients more effectively, or they're more resistant to pathogens or something like that. Can you?
Sure. The question, so Paul Stamets, he's the fungi guy. I think that's what he's known for. And so it is known that honeybees will actually go and forage on fungus. And so he paid attention, and working with Steve Shepard, Walter Shepard, in Washington, they've actually been running studies to actually measure the benefits. That's the important thing. A lot of things are developed for bees, and the problem is that if we don't have good data, we could be hurting the bees instead of helping the bees. We could be contaminating the honey with what we put in the hive instead of actually benefiting. And so the studies right now, the last talk I heard was in, he was at the American Beekeeping Federation in January, and where they are is that they have done the assays and found that these fungal extracts are active against viruses. And you heard me say, we have a virus problem. We have a mite spectrum virus problem, active against the viruses, and also in smaller cage studies, it's showing that it's effective. The big test is that if you put them into the hive, the whole functioning complex honeybee hive, will it still work? And that's being analyzed as we speak. I haven't heard an update, but I think once if it stays true for the whole hive, then Paul has very generously, he makes money selling other products to humans. And so I have heard that he's actually willing to subsidize what he wants to sell to beekeepers. And it would be available at a pretty good price and would be active against viruses, which that's a hard order to fill. So it's pretty exciting. But we're not there yet. But the cool thing is that your bees are probably already foraging on fungus, which is kind of neat.
So this is a question that kind of follows what you were just saying. Rebecca, what role do you think neonicotinoids and other pesticides are playing as a fundamental driver in bee losses and the virulence of varroa mites?
Ooh, I wish I should have put money on how long it took for Neonic to come up in a conversation. So, Neonic and Cinnarids, remember how I divided our bees into honeybees and then all those native bees? I divided the bees because our honeybees are in our operation, if we can control for honeybees, we see very few pesticide issues. And I'm not saying that pesticide issues don't exist, but for honeybees, our managed bees, that's really our main concern. Now, I am a solitary native bee. There are some other bees that are social that are native, but let's talk about the solitary native bee, which is the majority of all the other bee species out there. They live in a stem or they live in a tunnel, and what they do is they gather pollen and they make a nice little pollen ball, they lay an egg on it, and then that egg, the larva, emerges and eats that pollen. If that pollen has pesticides, and I understand people don't like neonicotinoids, but let's just say, let's raise the bar and let's try to not have our bees have to have any pesticide. Does that sound good to anybody? So if it has a pesticide in it, then it absolutely impacts health. There are data that show that neonicotinoids are, actually some data at the University of Minnesota Bee Lab, Judy Wu Smart, did that show that neonics hurt honeybee queens, they hurt bumblebee queens. But if I was a native bee, I would be more worried about the impact of neonicotinoids. But I'm more worried about fungicides. And so fungicides are really detrimental to the microbiome of those pollen balls. And so I always like to bring the, let's be worried about more than one class of pesticides. And if you want to connect neonicotinoids right to honeybee losses, it's really hard to do because the data really support that Varroa, I have a wonderful graphic, they're driving the honeybee health bus, Varroa Destructor. So it's a really bad graphic, but it makes people laugh.
Can I add to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
The USDA does a survey, just to back you up, the USDA does a survey every year of major beekeepers, and the subjective reporting is that neonics are perceived to be on the lower level of driving colony losses, and you can look at that data yourself. Isn't that kind of right? They have a survey they do every year, and you can see what farmers think are impacting the health of their bees, and neonics and pesticides are pretty low on that.
It depends upon, so it depends, and there's a Bee Informed Partnership survey too,
yeah.
And it depends upon what kind of a beekeeper you are. So the minority of beekeepers in the country are commercial beekeepers, and they are managing the majority of the honeybees. And they are suffering through an 11-year survey now, fewer losses than backyard beekeepers or sideliners. And if you ask them what the biggest threat to honeybee health is, they'll say Varroa. But backyard beekeepers will report pesticides more. But part of it is that, honestly, for the beekeepers in the room, who here thinks it's easy? It's not. And it takes, I'm guessing, about 5 good years of getting into that hive and learning and understanding what you're looking at and what the bees need, because it changes over time. It changes each season. Each season is different because the weather changes, and the food that they're bringing into the hive is different. So it's harder to report on that survey, I think. So it does depend.
Thank you. I have a student question, and I am going to give precedence to students. So if there are any students out there, please ask questions. What can a student or young person do who has no property or ability to garden? What can they do to help save the bees?
We're looking at you. Do you want to start?
Okay, I would think educate yourself, right? That's probably the main thing that we should be doing. I mean, that's the one thing I would advise, right? I think you guys have probably got something to add on that, right? I mean, as you said, the main thing we need to know is we need the right information. So, of course, that's what I would say. I mean, perhaps support good organizations, right? Good initiatives. I mean, projects like yours as well. Do you guys have something to add?
I mean, I can tell you what we tried.
Yeah.
So MIT has this Center for Bits and Atoms, and they're trying to make like this economy 4.0 where you can kind of make everything locally. So they started a fab lab network. There's about 1,000 of these public labs throughout the world now. They all have a common set of equipment, and that includes like things like 3D printers, but also CNC manufacturing equipment. So you can draw like a shape in Illustrator, send that to the machine, and it will cut that exact shape out. I think you guys have some equipment like that at this library, like laser cutters, right? So we were partially founded in Fab Lab Barcelona, which is kind of, do you know those guys?
Yeah, we've worked
Tomas
with you guys.
Dias.
Yeah, exactly.
And like WeShare.
Yes.
All those guys. Europe has a lot of kind of circular economy stuff, maker spaces, and so we made these. We made our own beehive, basically, and it can be cut from the equipment in these labs. So we thought, okay, if we make these open source beehive plans, then you can make your own beehive, and then it's easier to get started. Maybe it's we promoted like natural beekeeping, so rather than a Langstroth, which is designed for standardization and like producing a lot of honey and keeping bees for pollination. We promoted top bar beekeeping, which is more of a natural style. They can draw their own comb and vary the cell sizes and everything. So we made these open source plans and put them online, and they're pretty popular, but I still don't think that Hive is like as good as some of the other ones that are on the market. But if you want to get involved and you're a design student, maybe you can figure out why. You can modify those plans and make a better beehive. That's one thing. Also, in order to make our system smart, we need lots of training data, which is basically human input. So what you can do with our with your phone right now is you can go up to a hive, you can record it, and then you can inspect it, and you can assign all that inspection information to the raw data that you get from your phone. We need the we can't just submit like unlabeled data to the AI because it won't know what it means. It needs the human operator input to make the system smarter. So if you want to participate and help us make a smarter AI, you can use the free app, go inspect a hive and log that data. And the more data we get, the smarter the system becomes. So that's another thing. But I think also there are community gardens in every city. So if you can, you know, if they don't have a beehive, maybe you can put one in there and get involved and try and promote that locally.
Yeah, all good answers. I think the if you were a student, were you with me this morning? Because one of it is you've got purchasing power, so support products and businesses that are bee-friendly. And the other is that you maybe go to a church, you go to school, you go to different businesses, you have different organizations, and they have land. And we like to say that even a pot of flowers is good enough. And so if you're a student, I bet you could just plant one plant this year and make something happen. But also just go to the places where you are visiting and say, hey, you know what? You've got a lot of green grass, and it takes a lot of input to keep it as green grass. Would you be open to maybe a different kind of material in your yard? And see if you could spearhead the project.
And one thing I would add is that there's a really big and wonderful CU Bee Club, so you could join the Bee Club. You don't have to be a beekeeper, but you can get educated that way. I'm combining a couple of questions for Aaron. As you synthesize the data collected from 2,000 plus hives, what are the most significant universal insights you are finding? And secondly, can your monitoring take the place of regular mite checks, like physical powdered sugar or alcohol wash mite checks?
Okay, so we got lucky and got this partnership with the Carl Hayden Bee Research Lab in Arizona. Do you know Dr. William Michael by chance? He's kind of, okay, there's probably a lot of people, but we did like a 9-month experiment. It was a controlled experiment in the desert where they had no natural forage, and there were 24 hives in this experiment, and we subjected the bees, or they did, they subjected the bees to sublethal doses of neonics, and we were able to detect with over a 90% accuracy which hives were exposed to neonics and which ones were, just on the way they sound. So what that means is rather than needing sophisticated equipment, just with a microphone, with some basic audio analysis, we can detect immediately when bees are exposed to these chemicals. So we think advanced warning can help prevent losses, and that's really exciting. We also, if you go to our blog, we are starting to collect a lot of data on beekeeper behavior, and we can start to look at trends in the data on what things can promote queen health or which practices lead to queen loss, and we have data to back that up. And as we get more people in the network, we're going to have more precise information about that. So I think in a year's time, I'll be able to answer that with a lot of enthusiasm because we'll have a lot more information. But right now, it's just been like grinding to get the money we need to really take this to the next level. And we've kind of got that now, but now we just need to hit the grindstone and work really hard for about 8 to 12 months. But part of what we're going to be doing is we're working with the Butterfly Pavilion here in Westminster. And we're they have a bunch of bee yards. So basically, we're going to be... The goal of this project is to see if we can detect the presence of Varroa just on based on the data that we get from our sensors. So if you put a buzz box in a hive, it listens to the hive, and we have temperature and humidity information, some weather information, and vibration data. Is that enough to tell you if there is Varroa in the hive and how heavily
there
infested
is
it is?
In the hive.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the U.S., yes, but like in Australia, you don't have it. It hasn't crossed the country yet, so there are some controlled. But you're right, it's everywhere, right? But how bad is it? Maybe that's another indicator that we can look for. Do you think that's a worthy study?
So the problem is that what's our threshold? And one of the very best Varroa actually management guides is the Honeybee Health Coalition, and they have a free online book that you can go through and learn about all about Varroa and all about the different ways you can manage. Any way out there to manage Varroa legally is explained, and you can look at efficacy in different conditions. And one of the neatest improvements they have is an actual decision tree, so you can go through and say, do an inspection, and you can give them your level of Varroa, the different conditions. Their thresholds are at 1% in brood rearing time and 2% in late season. So their thresholds are very, very low, but they're based on data that were collected in Canada, where they've actually been doing a little bit better job than we have here of keeping bees alive. The other thing, we have we just launched a project. We have had the project up for a while called Mite Check, but we just launched an app. And so you can download the Mite Check app, and you can record your mite levels, put them on a national map that we have on mitecheck.com. But we also have instructional, because I know it's not fun to test for Varroa, but it's so important. So we have instructional videos on how to do it. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're the expert. Good? Yeah.
Okay, here's one more for Rebecca. Why should we like wasps? I've learned to tolerate them in my greenhouse, but dodging them can be hazardous.
Okay, first of all, the social behavior of wasps is absolutely fascinating. And so the upside-down umbrella Polistes paper wasps, the queens actually beat their daughters into submission so that they stay on the nest and take care of the brood. I haven't seen Game of Thrones, but I'm guessing, like, I've heard there's a lot of violence there. You just go to the natural world, it's out there. Wasps are very beneficial, and we've been talking about pesticides, and who wants to use more pesticides? Well, nature's pesticide is wasps. I had this lovely farmer tell me the story. He's an organic farmer, and he saw, I think it was a cabbage pest, and he didn't know what he was going to do to treat his whole farm, or his cabbage. And then all of a sudden, he saw the wasps coming, and they would come, cut the larva in half, and carry it away to their nest. And again, more violence, interesting. But he said he was going to have to do an intervention. It would have been organic, but the wasp literally took care of the problem for him. And so if we just let kind of nature take care of itself, sometimes they can do pretty amazing things because they want to be in control and in balance in populations. I do understand that I don't care if I get stung, but I get it. I get that people don't like it. But we just do have the yellow jacket wasps. They don't just show up in August. That's when most people get stung. They've been living there all season long, and we just haven't been paying attention. So if we pay attention, we can avoid some of our stings. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Here's a student question. Right now, the economy drives non-bee-centric beekeeping. So when everything is open source or free, where is the economy driving bee-centric practices?
Follow you.
Is the question, who asked that question?
Student.
Oh, you did, okay. I just want to make sure I understand it. So are you asking how we can make an economy that prioritizes bee health?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're like trying to open source all the information, and then you're trying to get everyone to do it for free, like plants for free or beehives for free, where's like the economy that's going to drive the bee-centric rather than the honey production that drives it right now, or pollination for large crops?
Yep.
So where would be the incentive and economy that would help drive that?
Well, we ran into that problem because we did that in a yoga campaign based on this idea. It went viral, but we only had about $30,000 at the end, which sounds like a lot, but it's really not to build hardware, software, and have data scientists. So we were like, wow, this open source thing doesn't necessarily drive the economics. It doesn't make it make sense. So we started a for-profit company, and we sell hardware, and we have a subscription model that'll come out for like professional features. So we're trying to make a viable company. Another route that you can go is to have a foundation that backs you, some kind of patron that backs your open source development. So the reason I didn't do that is because I spent about 3 years building a nonprofit, and then a board comes in and then they have all the power and they might not have worked to build it. It's kind of just, it's disheartening to have your work taken from you in a sense. So I was like, well, I'll make a company that at least I have control over, and I'll try and be kind of a philosopher king, a person with a lot of power, but then use it for good. So we're at that point now, but I also think we are starting to work with commercial beekeepers. There's a guy named Israel Bravo in Idaho, and for about 10 years, he had this idea, and then he finally was able to execute it with the right backing. They build cold storage facilities that are optimized for bee health. So they're huge buildings. They have stacks and stacks of beehives in the wintertime. They regulate CO2, temperature, and humidity and light levels, and they reduce winter losses from 40% down to about 5%. And their buildings have capacity for 300,000 hives, and they're sold out for 5 years. Like they have, there's only about 4 million hives in the U.S., so having 300,000, that's a pretty big impact on the industry. So he's super excited about our technology, and so his customers will become our customers, and their data will contribute to our system. And so as we get those bigger players online, we'll have a much bigger data set to play with, and that can make a bigger impact, I think. But also we have to make something that helps the economics of beekeepers, and part of what we want to do is help them make healthier honeybees, which then are more productive when they go out to pollinate these crops, and they can maybe leverage better deals when they broker their hives to these ag companies. That's as far as I've gotten in my thinking. I'm definitely open to being enlightened in other ways, if there are other ways of doing this. But the bigger issue is we're kind of in a context that we can't control. Like climate change is such a bigger problem, and it impacts this industry, and we don't have the tools to necessarily solve that right now, not with what we're doing. I think environmental regeneration is a big part of this, not only around hives, but you know, building the world's ecosystems again. And I think companies like Biocarbon Engineering, which many of you may have seen, they're out of Oxford, and they use drones to plant forests. A single drone can plant 30,000 pre-germinated seed pods a day, and they're looking at planting billions of trees a year. Stuff like that gives me hope because it's scalable. But I don't know, I'm kind of rambling at this point. I don't know. I wanted to also hear from the audience as well, so if we have time for that, I'd love it.
Okay, thanks. Well, let's see. If people want to respond on a card, then we can keep that conversation going.
Yeah, we're doing it already.
Yeah. Leslie, as you look at the habitats and behavior of bees, what kind of biophilic design directions might they inspire?
Who asked this question? Yeah, well, you're referring to basically biomimicry, you know, how, what we can, perfect, great. I mean, absolutely, we see lots of designs. I mean, of course, nature has had billions of years of trial and error, so it only makes sense that we would copy what's already been done. Yeah, we've seen lots of different solutions, perhaps not necessarily inspired by hives, but I mean, we've seen buildings designed by designed to mimic termite mines, basically, and I mean, that's because they're so well insulated. So, I mean, we see a lot of stuff like that. And we have in recent years seen a lot of robotics that basically try to mimic insects and also bees. So, you know, a lot of tiny robots to execute certain tasks. I don't know how practical that is, but I mean, it's very interesting that people are sort of exploring these ways. Okay, how can we, you know, replicate this behavior to solve issues? But I mean, absolutely, I think biomimicry is certainly, and there's a panel on it tomorrow, is certainly the way forward. And I think it's, yeah, it's the only way I think we're going to solve a lot of these problems if we want to create innovative solutions without creating more problems. So I don't know if you guys want to add on that.
Okay. This is back to honeybees again. What is the status of vaccinations for honeybees, and what role does constant treatment for varroa play in developing mite resistance?
Yeah.
Okay. So we just submitted a grant today to look at, it's a company in Minnesota that has vaccinations for viruses. And so we just submitted a grant today. If funded, it would be funded in late 2020 or mid-2020. So we're certainly interested in it as far as if there are ways that we could protect the bees using vaccinations, but I don't know of anything else. I don't know of anything commercially available, but I think people are talking about it. As far as treating varroa, managing varroa, there are, if you look at the Honeybee Health Coalition report, there are so many different varroa management options that we can create the best integrated pest management plan if we are diligent. One of our biggest issues with managing varroa is that it really doesn't have anything to do anymore with managing the varroa that are reproducing in your hive, because that's pretty easy. We know that varroa will reproduce. We know that if we knock them down before the spike, sorry for all you non-beekeepers, just stick with me for a minute, but if we knock them down before the spike of varroa, then we're going to have less of a problem. The issue is that this pest that it has become such a problem is now really a problem, at least where I'm from and in a lot of places, because of the horizontal transmission of varroa. So it used to be that varroa would take a colony down in a couple of years and the colony would just die. But over time, there's the colony that collapses and very few bees are left in the colony. But now data are showing us that they're going into other colonies. So your beekeeping problem is no longer your beekeeping problem. If you choose to let your bees die from varroa, they leave the hive. There are data that show they could be going up to a mile, if not more, from your apiary into other people's hives. And that is a huge problem. So the question goes about resistance. Well, there are so many different organic ways or natural ways to manage mites. Resistance is not the biggest issue for other backyard beekeepers. For commercial beekeepers who have fewer options, they're certainly worried about it, and they're rotating their mite treatments to defer resistance. But there are ways you can manage colonies with not using any kind of synthetic intervention. Again, sorry for the non-beekeepers.
Okay, here's another student question. Today, Majority of GMO food is modified to be resistant to BT, an organic microbe found in soil to kill insects. Since our food now is modified to have BT in every plant cell, including pollen, and BT is proven to negatively impact pollinators, do you think our food system will ever stray away from GMOs created for BT resistance? What is your opinion on GMOs?
I'm just going to quickly. We really don't have good data that GMOs are a problem for bees. And so for bees, again, it's one of those things where if you don't like GMOs, that's fine. You just have to pick a different reason to say because the science doesn't back it up for when it comes to bees. And I didn't mean to be mean when I said that.
Okay.
All right. I have nothing I can add.
Nothing to add. Okay. Are bee-friendly organizations working with Future Farmers of America? Are FFA members supportive of bee health?
So we don't have any specific programs with FFA. We've talked to them before, and I know they're not anti-bee health. I don't know of any actual programs that we have operating. I just know they come to our campus every year, and we often will go and give a talk to the members. It's probably a pretty good in. We're working with a number of different extension groups and trying to make sure we're getting the message out there, but we don't have any of them. I don't know if you know of any.
This is a little tangential, but I was at the ABF conference last year, and one of the brightest spots of that event was there was a nonprofit that I can't recall what their name is, so forgive me for that. But in general, the form of the idea is that rather than demonizing farmers for using pesticides, we need to build these coalitions where we understand one another's interests and try and find some compatibility. So. Part of the problem, well, if we have empathy for farmers, you know, they've all been locked into this industrial farming system promoted by Monsanto, and they can't really break out of it because you have to be on a clock, like a factory, using these products, and your profit margins are going down and down and down every year, and it's really tough. They have a tough line of work. Part of what they do requires pesticide use, but there are ways that they can use pesticides more responsibly that can have a positive impact on pollinators. For example, spraying at night is better than spraying during the day when bees are more active and they're flying around, right? So that alone is one thing that you can do. Also, making sure that you use pesticides legally, because a lot of people overspray, so spraying within legal limits is another thing. Maybe building relationships with your neighbors so that you can kind of have a management plan that works for everybody. I think that's something we can do. I've also heard part of the problem is that states are now mandating that like grain that passes across their highways needs to be sprayed with fungicides or weed killers. And so that is just like basically the government is mandating that we use these pesticides on a massive scale, and that I think is also contributing to the problem. So if I had unlimited power to execute the vision that we are building, I would put enough sensors throughout the U.S. to build a strong enough data, an argument backed by data, so that we could change public policy and get a lot of these pesticides either banned or severely restricted in their use. But we need a lot of citizens to mobilize a campaign like that. We need a lot of data. So I don't really have aspirations for doing that at the moment. I'm just trying to focus on stuff that's more immediate. But I think the planet does deserve some radical action, and it takes a lot of people to build a movement like that. So I don't know what it's going to take to build something like that. I mean, I don't know. But we need something, because these small-scale programs aren't going to do it. We need a kind of a radical reorganization of our economy in order to solve these kinds of problems, because they just keep stacking on top of each other again and again, and it's kind of daunting, mm-hmm. You know.
So following up on that, how important do you think it is to have governments involved in solving the problem of how to save the world. Can you just address that a little bit from your perspectives?
Anybody?
Do you want to go? Oh, sorry.
I mean, with anything, of course, it's incredibly important, but at the same time, I don't think we should rely on it. Of course, that's the ideal scenario, but I think everywhere we really can, even dealing with experts in bees, of course, designers, students, I think there's also, there's so many things, what we've learned today, that we can do. But at the same time, it needs to definitely be co-collaborative. As I've learned just now, of course, it doesn't make any sense if you make a solution and you haven't consulted with someone who's an expert. So, I mean, that's incredibly important, and that's, of course, Design 101. It needs to be, yeah, a collaborative process. So, of course, we should rely on governments and push for those kinds of changes, but not forget that we play a huge role in basically ensuring they stay alive in our food security of the future.
I'm from Minnesota, and our government is really supportive of bees. They took a ton of money. They took, I think, $500,000 from a granting program and allocated it to our native bee professor so that he could do a program in southwestern Minnesota where there's a lot of corn and soy, and we know the beekeepers have moved out because they're not making enough honey. Honeybees are great to tell us if there's enough food around, right? And so it's great to be in a state that's really supportive, and they can get things done. And all of our state agencies, every single big bee conference we have, they show up, and representatives are absolutely part of the solution. So I speak from a place where I come from, a very supportive state, and it makes a huge difference. At the same time, when I asked how many people here are gardeners, I think that's a driving force for some of you coming to a bee program, and you are the ones that are executing great change right in your soil. You're making a huge difference, and that I think can, if the government's not doing enough, then it's the people, you know, who are the multiple actions put together that are making a difference.
I think that's exactly right. I think if you take all the immoral actions committed by, say, a large corporation, but then you look at the consumers that buy the products of that corporation, and you add up all the immoral behaviors on a small scale that we all take, that adds up to the same, that would balance the scales of these big actors. I think if we could mobilize and change the way that we act, then that can counterbalance some of the bigger problems of the world. But it's just hard to change human behavior. It's a whole other topic. I don't even want to open it up. But.
Well, and we are out of time, so I just want to thank our panelists for inspiring us. I think we have our mandate now to go out. It's up to us. So thanks, everybody.